Very good. We are studying Bava Batra,
and the Mishnah that we started from is on 7b2. And I want to go back again just to mention, since we had the Thanksgiving break and we had a lot of turkey, and we're full, and we forgot part of what we learned. So at least I needed to reread today before we started again, that we are talking about compelling residents to give dollars as in a taxation system. I want to be clear here that we're talking about a taxation system within the context of what is called, at this point, the city. If you will, like a small city-state, if you will, a polis. When you talk about this period in history, the rabbinic period, and you talk about this classical period, you're talking about the construct of this city administration that can put obligations onto individuals, and the city then becoming responsible, in whatever way you want to call the city at that point, for the Jewish people, a small city-state or a civil administration, if you will, a political organization, small p. And you're talking about that being very unique and different from any system of redistribution of wealth that happens in the context of Torah.
What context?
Of Torah. Of Torah. It's important to remember in the background of all of what we're studying that in Torah there are several ways that an individual in an agricultural society is responsible for sharing wealth.
Yeah, but the difference between the Torah commandment about sharing wealth is to help individual. This case is to improve property value.
Okay, so it's a different. I'm not looking at it as property value at all. I'm looking at it as the individuals within the city getting their due, whether it's for defense, which we saw last time because we were talking about walls and defense walls, or, frankly, the apportionment of some city resources to meet their needs, which we haven't really arrived at yet. But we're talking about the organization that's not just about property value and real estate and hard property. We're talking about ethics and that which the rabbis saw as being part of political, corporate political responsibility here, affecting, at least we've, what we have encountered in the passages we've read so far, the poor people passing by my courtyard. Okay, and because that was mentioned here, this is a classic locus of questions about the ethics of human beings, their wealth, the taxes we pay, and not to see them as only like an IRS taxation, but the redistribution of wealth to meet the needs of all those in my city, which gets into the question of tzedakah on the whole. How do we deal with a distribution of resources that, equitable or not, make sure that the poor get their due, right? So that's why this Mishnah and these pages are the pages we're looking at. And my point is, before we get back into the material tonight, I just wanted to review again, the Torah system for dealing with the poor and individuals who have resources to potentially share primarily deals with several areas of agricultural law. Right? What are the three that we know from the field?
Gleaning,
leket.
The first fruits.
Well, there's definitely the tithing, third year for the Levites. So that's the tithe, the maser. Well, so I'm not talking about land release. I'm talking about actual dealing with those who have no field of their own. So I have gleaning. I have the corners of the field, which is peah.
Isn't that part of it?
And then I have the. I have maser. That's the tithing. I have leket. Which is the gleaning that I leave there, and then shchicha, which is that which I quote-unquote forget, which drops. My
can
point,
drop?
You don't.
Yeah. Oh. Well.
You can or you don't.
Okay.
But the point is that that's agriculture, and it's my agriculture, it's my field, and the biblical notion of tzedakah generally, all the way up through Deuteronomy, is the individual who has some resources, where there is the poor who live in that agricultural reality that I live in, and how those people ultimately eat. Right? Deuteronomy has it a little different, just to be clear about what's in Deuteronomy. And that is, Deuteronomy says the following. You shall not harden your heart and clench your hand against your brother the pauper. But you shall surely open your hand to him and surely lend to him enough for his want that he has. So again, we saw at the outset of rabbinic sources about tzedakah that one of the highest levels according to the kind of ladder approach that we saw in the early Leviticus Rabbah in the literature is not teach a man to fish. It's to give him a loan. Right? And keep that in mind for how we ultimately think about the ladders of tzedakah, or what we think about the ladder of tzedakah that the Rambam wrote later on in the Rambam's codification. Watch yourself, back to Deuteronomy, watch yourself lest there be in your heart a base thing, saying, the seventh year, the year of remission is near, and you look meanly at your brother the pauper, and you do not wish, and you do not give to him, and he call the Lord against you, and it be an offense in you, you shall surely give to him, and your heart shall not be mean. And therefore, there's the Shemitah cycle and the Yovel cycle, Bobby, that you mentioned, that in fact these years might indeed affect the way you relate to the poor, and you may not give over that loan because you have to, you have to forgive it. When you give it, for virtue of the thing, your Lord God will bless you in all your doings and in all your hand reaches, for the pauper shall not cease from the midst of the land. There I charge you, saying, you shall surely open your hand to your brother, to your poor, to your pauper in the land. Again, important for us to understand is the context of the individual, regarding the individual that's in the land. At this point, another way to say the same, is that there's not a city. There's no city administration rules about how we go about dealing with economic justice. Tzedakah, the righteousness that we want to see within the context of society. What is to be noticed in that regard is that the rabbinic move, the rabbinic moment, a la the Mishnah we've learned, some Gemara we've been in, a Mishnah we'll look at tonight in the books that we took off the shelves, is that the rabbinic moment is in fact the moment when, after all the agricultural measures are completely specified within the Mishnaic corpus, in Mishnah Peah, which is in the books in front of us, the Mishnah in front of us, after the exact amounts are discussed vis-a-vis all those areas of agricultural tzedakah that are in Torah, the rabbinic move, the rabbinic moment is to say, we live differently now. If we want to pursue tzedakah, and if we want to pursue dealing with poverty, then we need to understand it in the context of city life. And we need to understand it in the context of incorporated political organized life in what we call the city. What we are calling the polis. What we are basically saying is that this, the cityscape now helps define how we live when it comes to living amidst this built-in community that's in our city, those who may come through the gates and those who may be inside the walls. We will have certain responsibilities. Those responsibilities might, on the one hand, seem like public works, taxation for the buildup of the city in which we live, just like currently our taxes are supposed to work for creating the structures, the realities, the systems, the programs, etc. But we can't forget that internally to the Jewish polis, to the Jewish city, there is no quote-unquote expectation that there's a central government with all the kinds of departments, checks and balances, system of democracy that exists today. We can't just reread onto the Gemara the notion that, oh, of course people are organized like this, because look how we're organized here in America. Look how we're organized there in Israel today. We can't do that. The rabbinic moment is to see, hey, there's a great empire here. There are wonderful, amazing empires here. They all demand tributes, and they have this kind of demand with a tax and that kind of gift that I... Oh, in our space that we're allowed to live freely, we have to figure out how to actually live with the pursuit of tzedakah, the pursuit of financial redistribution, now as a reality. And by the way, we're no longer living on just agricultural fields, and the Torah's concepts and constructs for providing for the poor may not be the ones we need, given the fact that we live like this now. Now, some will still have fields, and some will still have to understand what it means to have fields, and how to do leket, and how to do shechicha, and what to do with shechicha, what to do with the forgotten sheaves, and what to do with the gleanings, and how to leave the corners of the field. That's why the Mishnah will also include all those specific measurements in Masechet Pe'ah, the corners of the field tractate. But we have to sense the great change in, and sense the great systemic approach, and sense that tzedakah kind of goes along with this taxation approach in the way that the rabbis are setting up a system for living, of utilizing resources, of demanding contributions from individual citizens, and for the rabbis themselves, who are helping figure this out and codify it, where they fit in, and if, quote-unquote, as we saw last week, they should be taxed at all. Interesting questions for the rabbis, especially for themselves. So, I want to read you... I mean, what's wonderful is that it just turns out that we're studying this material, and one of my dearest Talmud teachers is just writing about the depths of all of what we had been studying and are studying, and he's presenting by way of policy making in the state of California, and to anyone from governmental agencies who will listen to Jewish advocacy from the pages of Gemara, being informed by pages of Gemara that he's the rabbi in residence of one of these kind of groups that goes and teaches anyone and everyone the kind of values and realities reflected within these several pages of Gemara that we are really focused on.
Jewish Secretary of Treasury, maybe?
Maybe. But what he's involved with is explaining to students of the Talmud just how much of a moment this was for the rabbis. So to further enhance the learning here, we have a little bit of what his reflections are in this way. So this was written, by the way, in the Journal of Religious Ethics. This is an article written for the Journal of Religious Ethics in 2015. So I'll read you his introduction. It was he includes a quote by Peter Brown, who's a historian of this period. Peter Brown, wonderful historian of this classical period, including rabbinic, including Greco-Roman, Roman interaction throughout the world during that time. It was always the city that was, in the first instance, the recipient of gifts. Or if not the city, the civic community. The demos, or the populace of the city. It was never the poor. what one can call a civic model of society prevailed. A rich man was praised for being a philopatris, a lover of his home city. Never for being a philopatochus, a lover of the poor. There was little room in such a model for the true urban poor, many of whom would in fact have been impoverished immigrants, non-citizens living on the margins of the community. So what's important for our second century, year 200 CE, understanding of the Mishnah is that while it did mention the poor, and while the focus that we have when we think about tzedakah often is on the poor, and the languages of Leviticus Rabbah again, Vayikra Rabbah, did indeed explain about the various kinds of definitions of who is poor, who is impoverished, what the personality types are, to humanize them in a very deep way, was the introductory texts we dealt with. What I wanted to do, pulling out a little bit again before we get back to the material, is I wanted to just point out that we could, in our kishkas, be reacting like, why are we dealing with taxation texts and what sounds like taxation systems if Rabbi Bolton said we're dealing with tzedakah in the sources? It's because the way that society is organized for the rabbis is about organizing cities, polis, the organization of community that extends itself to the point where those who are at risk are protected, those who are hungry are provided for. And it's different for them than if we think of by us having a class of poor, the poor. It's different for some who really interpret all the way to the other side of, like, let's say the spectrum is a class of the poor and the city-state and where and how I have to be philanthropic. That it's different for someone to be a philopatris, a very charitable soul to the city. It sounds very different, like it's two ends of the spectrum. But if we were to say, what does it mean to be that generous? It is to consider everything you need for a safe community and everything you need for the poor within that community to be taken care of. And that's different than texts that just come to tell you, well, let me tell you what you should do with that poor person who is knocking at the door. It's a very important kind of context for reading these Gemaras that we're going to read that seem to be talking about the rabbi's refusal to pay taxes themselves. Well, wait a minute. So what does it mean when they say that? Are they considering themselves like we would call the poor old Talmidei Chacham, literally poor Talmidei Chachamim? In general, they're poor and they have no resources, and therefore they're talking about not paying taxes? Because those who are taxed, if you will, are not just responsible for income tax and then charity above that. It's that the system of taxation within the polis is the system to contribute from one's resources, and that is accounted for, quote-unquote, tzedakah on the whole. That's righteous Jewish living. Because when you don't have a farm, and you don't leave pay, and you don't do leken, and you don't have shemicha, and you don't have the agricultural pieces, you're figuring out a way with the resources you do have and with the where you're living now piece how to create this kind of reflection of the pursuit of tzedakah and justice that the Torah talked about in agricultural terms. All right? So it's a remaking of the preface of our study to deepen our understanding of why the texts we're learning and how they relate to the larger question of tzedakah. Yeah?
So instead of an individual handing out money, our commitment to the city, to the polis, is the equivalent. And the polis, or the city, or the group, is responsible for taking care of the poor within their midst.
So, to here, exactly.
I'm confused.
Exactly. Arthur, here's where I'm going to muddy the water that you just said, because you restated it wonderfully. That's what I presented. Oh, the rabbis at a certain point will also have a rabbinic moment where they're going to say, is that enough? But yes.
Of course.
Yes.
I was just confused because if the city is providing for the poor, what are we talking about? Are we talking about poor houses? Are we talking about soup kitchens? In this time, what are we talking about?
Nice. So let's open the Mishnah. That's what we need this for.
So would you say this is a Jewish contribution to go beyond this Greco-Roman system and to make it more of an individual responsibility?
Well, I would say that it's developing parallel to some Greco-Roman legal thinking as to how we're going to relate to the same kind of issues that they're relating to. And there is some, through these texts that we're reading, a desire to record the legal disputes, the legal narrative, the nomos, the narrative of our approaches to these questions within Mishnah and within the Talmud, as we further define the poor in our cities and create a class of poor with whom to think about and for whom to think about these issues. Look at with me in Peah chapter 8, Mishnah 7.
Which page?
It's on page 117 of the volume that you have in front of you. Okay, these are from the shelf. Over here we had a number of copies of volume number 1 of the Kahati Mishnah, if you would just share if they're not enough for everyone. So this is the moment that after all of the different measures that have been discussed in the 8 chapters up through Mishnah 6 of Peah, I want to show you inside here with this Mishnah chapter 8, Mishnah 7 of Peah, this rabbinic moment, if you will, that I'm talking about. And Rana, it answers your question in a certain way. Okay? So, Ein pochatin le'ani ha'over mimakom l'makom mikikar befundayon me'arbasein besela. They do not give a poor person who wanders from place to place less than a loaf worth a pundion when 4 seyas cost a sella. So, a little bit of calculation here about ancient funds and money. That's not the important part. What the important thing is to notice is that I've come out of the field, if you will, I'm no longer dealing with the agricultural reality, and I am giving a name to a person who has less, ani, and I'm also saying that he can be a wanderer from place to place, and I'm giving him a loaf and not just leaving crops in my field for him, right? So you have this notion of a worth, pundion when 4 sellas cost a sella. You see that Kahati does us a great service if you flip the page and just keep your finger back on the Mishnah. 4 sellas are 24 kavs. 1 sella equals 48 pundions. 1 kav is therefore sold for 2 pundions, and a loaf costing 1 pundion is made from half a kav of wheat. Since, however, the shopkeeper must cover the expenses of grinding and baking, he cannot sell a loaf made from half a kav of wheat at the market price of 1 pundion, but only from a quarter of a kav. However, when distributing grain to the poor who have to grind the wheat and bake the bread, they must not be given less than half a kav. But when they are given a baked loaf, it is only from a quarter of a kav, the bulk of 6 eggs, which is for food for 2 meals. Food for 2 meals. Point being, you're not only talking about wheat for grain, you're talking about a place where there's a communal oven, talking about a loaf, talking about maybe a shop where someone is selling, and they have a responsibility to make sure that the poor person who passes from place to place is included in his, oh, here's what my business needs to include today, needs to include my selling my loaves for X number of however, whatever the money is that I'm using, plus, in my mind, I know that I'm going to have to be sharing with a poor person who goes mimakom lemakom, place to place.
So who's the they?
Who's the they? This is people of a polis.
So it's not a government responsibility. It's an individual responsibility.
It is a, let's say, municipal ordinance.
Oh.
The Mishnah is creating, like, municipal ordinances. These are law codes, right? So this is the way we have to kind of see it. Lan, if he stays overnight, the word lan, lalun, is to stay and rest. Also, at its core, what is lan? Lanu. It's like Michelanu. So there are those who propose that lalun, kind of, that person's ours for the night. We take responsibility for our guests. Nice little drush. Lan notnin lo parnasalina. We give him a night's outfit. In other words, we let him have some dignity. What is it?
Lehalin, which is to kill someone. Lehalin al Misha.
Uh-huh.
It's the same root.
Lalshin?
Lalshin is like a...
No, the Lotora.
No, it's not the same meaning, but the same root. Same letters.
Is it?
Yeah.
No.
Lalun.
Hey, Lalshin.
Anyway, it's the same root.
All right. I'm not sure what the connection is.
I don't see
the
connection.
Okay. So if he stays the night, you give him a night's outfit. Shavat, if he's there for Shabbos, notnin lo mazon shalosh seudot. You really have to include him in the three meals.
Picking up on what Rana said, the day, is there anywhere it says how this is to be administered specifically?
Well, the rabbis themselves consider themselves to be the teachers of the people. The city administrators are appointed by Anshei Ha'ir, and they become Ziknei Ha'ir. So we do have, as we mentioned in Brachot, we have people who become those who are responsible within a city area, within a municipality, to make sure that people are really doing this. And if they had shotrim and shoftim, like we have from Torah already, that there are certain people who qualify as judges and certain people who qualify as police educators, with a hyphen, by the way. I like how Sefer HaChinuch defines shotrim. Shotrim, my son taught me, is his bar mitzvah parsha. And he said, look at this, Abba. Shotrim, how's a shoter? What is a shoter? The chinuch says it's not just a police officer like you're under arrest. The shotrim took it upon themselves to learn the rules of engagement in society from the judges and from the leaders, and they went out and they were mechanchim. They were proactive and they were teaching about the law. He was only hoping that he was going to find that the Jewish police officer was also allowed to, like, do it over basketball games or like, some kind of, you know, sounds like a good right. job to him. Mi sheyesh lo mazon shtei sudot, he who has food for two meals. Now, this is interesting by way of the question that Rana asked. Who's the they and what's the institution? If the people individually and privately have already provided the food for two sudot, lo yitol min hatamchui. He doesn't then go to the soup kitchen and say, now give me two meals here. In other words, if the townspeople did their piece, this is an either or. He has two meals worth of food if he's there for the night. He doesn't go to the soup kitchen to get the two meals. He's satisfied with what he's got. So it's either, in this case, the private individual within the municipality, or it's this institution, the Tamchui.
What's 14 meals?
So then he says, Mazon arbas resudot, if he has enough for 14 meals, obviously he's a guy who passes from place to place, and he's going to be there for a few days, right? Lo yitol mina kupa. He can't get a monetary disbursement from the local tzedakah collective. The money, the tzedakah money. Now, that's all we need in the Mishnah to understand about what institutions exist. There are individuals who have personal responsibility with their shops to provide a loaf. You make then the parallel to whatever it is your shop is as a shopkeeper. You know, if you make nice little colorful macaroons, maybe you have to give them X number of macaroons. If you make this or that, maybe you decide, this Mishnah really says, I should be providing. Or maybe you say, no, the Mishnah is talking about the shopkeeper when it comes to grain and loaves, and at least the guy who has the grain, makes loaves, knows exactly what to do. And we have to ask the rabbis, what do we do with all this? You know, he's got his responsibility. Well, I give money to the tamchuli. I give money to the soup kitchen for those who pass from place to place in this new urban setting. Oh, so that's fine. The guy at the bakery didn't give him the loaves. He didn't have enough for two meals in his pocket from some which way that he got both loaves and maybe a little bit more over here from this one who has a different kind of stand at the shuk who gave him a little bit, just like the guy who makes the loaves gave him a little bit. Then he goes to the tamchui that we've supported as those B'nai Ha'ir. We are the people of that city. And by the way, there's beyond a soup kitchen that makes food for those who pass by place to place, there's what's called the kupa. So the kupa is the collection of funds that could be, obviously, for a little bit more than just two meals any one given day. That kupa is kind of equated, he's got enough for 14 meals, then he doesn't go and get his disbursement. But maybe if he's there for a few days, and he gets a loaf or two, but he knows he's going to be there, and he's really, you know, not able to go by the door each day, or doesn't want to go begging door to door, he goes to the kupa and says, I'm the wayfarer, I need a little help, can I get my disbursement? So these institutions are what my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Aryeh Cohen, called the rabbinic moment. When the rabbis move the ideals and systems of Torah, agricultural ideals and systems, into now new Mishnaic legislation and a way of approaching the way we deal with ani, the poor, who, as we mentioned before, is not yet totally a class unto himself. That will be recorded in the unfolding stories of these texts and the cities at work here, and not the field.
So can we assume that the soup kitchens and the kupa are connected to the synagogue?
Oh, no, no.
So where are these kitchens?
You know,
places where...
Imaginative looking at these ancient city setups. You know, like, where are they?
Yeah,
I'm not sure. Like, if you go to Yerushalayim today,
yeah,
and you want to volunteer at the local tamchui, Yad Sara, that was among the first established in the city, when they built outside of the old city walls, and they built up Yafo, and they have Machane Yehuda here, and you have the police station, and you have the Machane Yehuda neighborhood on this side. So just over here, at the loop where the bus stop used to be for the train, everybody who's been there maybe can see this.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Yad Sara, this soup kitchen, is sitting right there.
So it's there now.
There now, and was there. The synagogue, by the way, is directly across from the shul, and it's not connected. They didn't want one shul, one synagogue, to be the one who controls. Some synagogues, by the way, do that,
yeah,
and they have this kind of value and ideal, and they create the soup kitchen at their place, just like some of the churches. But no, in the ancient world and in Jerusalem, we don't assume that it was connected to the synagogue.
All right, so who administers the kupa?
So So here it says, "Vahakupa nig beit bishnayim." There were gabbais of the kupa. There were two people who do that. Umitchaleket bishlosha, and there were three who distributed it. Now, there are people who agree and disagree about whether or not it's the same two who collect and they sit with the get a third to distribute, or it's two who collect and it's a three completely different kind of... You can see from Kahadi's comments on 118 that these two are charity wardens because authority over communal affairs must be shared by at least two officers, and the money is distributed to the poor by three officers, for the distribution of charity must be administered by three, just as monetary lawsuits, which are judged by three judges. The tamchui, however, is collected and distributed by three because the distribution is made immediately after the collection, and if the collection were to be done by two, there would be the trouble of searching for a third person in order to distribute the tamchui. Now, it sounds like the tamchui is not about prepared food. It's not a soup kitchen in the classic sense. So there are those who say that the tamchui was the daily collection and the kupa was a larger collection for bigger disbursements. All right. Yeah.
This sort of organization within the community in Europe, you not have Jewish polises, but you have Jewish communities within larger communities, were organized along these lines. And they were recognized by civil authorities as having the authority to raise taxes and administer the civil affairs of the Jewish community, schools, hospitals, soup kitchens, and so on and so forth. I was going to ask why we don't have that here, but here with the strict separation of church and state, would probably not be willing to give the taxing authority and so on to a community. But it's not limited to it. I know my parents grew up in that environment.
No doubt about it. You're great to point it out because that's where we're going back to in our Talmudic literature, where we were kind of granted that permission. It's not just that we had hegemony in our land. We were under the Roman Empire granted this space. You could say the parallel is to the diaspora in Sasanian Persia, in Europe, until the time that you're talking about. And that we did seem to have this kind of approach with our resources, because, by the way, we even paid the tax back to the king, or the land barons, or the charter called for us to contribute to the local administrators of the non-Jewish authorities. But then we had within our polis these systems. Here's where I went with thinking about that, preparing and reading again. Today, the notion that you have one address for tzedakah that then disperses it and kind of keeps the kahila, keeps the Jewish polis within even the context in modernity alive, is kind of the concept of what a federation does. And there's, I think today, some tension about whether or not you kind of need to have as much of a centralized address as in the past, even past generations, one generation, two generations ago, right? But that it's true that even today, some of that consciousness and some of that style of organization still really exists within the Jewish community.
But you're talking about the Federation. The Federation does not have the right to demand a tenth.
Right, so that's the difference, right? They for sure cannot demand that everyone pay day school tuitions for the children who ought to be grade K through 8 in day school. I mean, you know, you could say that somebody opt out, but, you know, they have no power to say, build a wall around any part of a Jewish quote-unquote, you know, small metropolis that we have today. No, you're right. They have none of that power. And by the way, Rabbi Elliot Dorf points this out all the time in his, you know, modernity and traditional Judaism, not reform philosophy that says it's all a choice. that my choice to participate in the covenant is really bottom line all choice. He says, today, our covenantal arrangement here is not like I have these shotrim. It's not like I have these officers of the Beit Din coming around and saying, look, you guys really need to get into Jewish shape here. That there is some willingness that a person needs to have, some through one's own free will, to engage in this covenantal reality, Jewish law reality, and it's necessary to, in a certain way, give oneself over to the would-be authority that is represented through texts like the ones we're studying, and then the Kehillah as a construct throughout Jewish ages, in order to have the kind of obligation, the chiyuv, that we were made to really agree to, were made to agree to, I said that specifically, in the past. And so there's a lot today in modernity that's not exactly the same, right? All right, let's push forward, back into text. I just wanted, before we leave this issue, the Tosefta says what the Mishnah said in a little bit of a different language, and I just wanted to point out one thing that the Tosefta said. The Tosefta is a parallel Tanaitic text that did not make it into the Mishnah, made it into Tosefta, and it says, "Ein po chatin la'ani ha'over mimakom l'makom mikikar befundion me'arba sa'in b'sela lo notnin lo parnasat linash." So the same thing about the loaf, and the same thing about the giving him a place to be for a night and a garment to be in. Shabbat, vis-a-vis Shabbat, no ninlo mazon shalosh sudot.
Just go to the garment.
What's that?
He says it's a garment because I thought it was going to be a garment, and they said it was like a pillow and a mattress. That's the outfit for Shabbat. I thought that was interesting.
All in one.
Yeah, okay, so you have a place to sleep. Whether that's a night garment that covered you enough that if you slept on the floor you wouldn't totally get dirty, or it's a nice pillow and a blanket. I think in the Gemara they say it's a pillow and a blanket, but Mishnaically, pshat, I think you could translate it back to a beged lina, a beged that you can wear. B'med divrim amurim, it adds this. When does all this really take effect? Bezman she'ein mikirin oto. At a time that you don't know the person. Aval bezman she'mikirin oto. Af mechasin oto. But at the time that you know him, you even have to, you know, make sure that he's covered in all the different ways. Physically, it's not just the meals. That you have to really like make sure that all the needs are really taken care of. Haya misaviv al haptachim ein nizkakin lo lechol davar. But if he's going around and knocking at every door for his needs, you don't have to be the only one to take care of everything. So again, there's got to be shared responsibility. What does it lead to? Ultimately, people are able to say, well, maybe someone else will do it. But also, it creates the need for humanizing that person who's knocking door to door and really asking and being able to have the dialogue, do you have everything you need? What else is it that you're looking for? Right, that level of interaction with the someone who's in this situation.
What's the implication for Matapakira? I mean, that language was, you supplies when they don't know the person. What if they do?
I'm reading that as a separate clause. That after we say about the one I don't know versus the one I do know, then there's a guy who was going round and round to the different...
No, I may have misunderstood at the beginning of the clause. I thought, again, and it said, this applies when they don't know him. Does the language say...
When does the last stuff I told you about, meaning for the three meals, apply?
B'zman
she'ein makirin oto, ava b'zman she'makirin oto, af mechasin oto. That you cover all
the... You know him, you need to take care of
that. I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Do you know him, you do even more?
Yeah.
Is that what they're saying?
Exactly. And you cover all his needs. So it sounds like it's beyond the three meals. Period. And then you get, the guy's going door to door...
No, that's fine.
So that's the distinction between not knowing and knowing.
Right.
I didn't
over here... It added this notion of going door to door. That's the point. And so this gets back into our Gemara passages where, at least we saw, people were going chatzer le chatzer. They were going courtyard to courtyard. And thus the questions about the walls and the gates that we were building and whether or not these folks would pass by and get, quote-unquote, their due or be able to ask for what they need. Okay, now let's go back to our Gemara text. We were holding at 8A1. So turn to 8A1. And I want to just press this piece a little further. The rabbis are really talking about feeling like maybe they should not be taxed, like they're unjustifiably taxed. And we're thinking about the question, why are the rabbis kind of taking themselves out of the picture of being contributors in this regard? Is it that they have no money at all? Is it that they feel like there is a class or a group dynamic where they shouldn't really be the ones participating? We have to kind of put those questions out there as to why this approach. But at the same time, you get a little bit of insight into... they're feeling themselves the important students who will ultimately bring about redemption and maybe contributing in that way. Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, I'm on the left side in the middle. Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista, Rama Karga Ad Rabbanan. Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista once imposed a head tax on the rabbis as part of a general levy. In other words, they had chosen the head tax direction and not a family tax direction. Okay? So note that Rav Nachman bar Rav Chista is a Rav, and he imposes the head tax on the rabbis. So it is a rabbi kind of saying, hey, I think we should have this head tax. This policy is coming from me, a rabbi. The action encounters opposition, shall we say. Amar le Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak teaches, Avrat ad Reiter, you have violated a precept of the Torah. It's a Torah precept that you that's a strong reaction, right? The if someone is breaking a rule adaraita, then you are really breaking something in the rabbinic system that is really high level. And by the way, I'm going to tell you that you've also transgressed what I could learn if I was learning from the prophets. And I was learning from the writings. So I have three drushes to say to you, you're wrong. How does a rabbi, you know, fight public policy that he disagrees with? He comes with he comes with three drushes loaded in the weapon. I got three drushes for you. He's armed with three drushes. First, I'm going to give you a drush from one of the verses in the Torah. Even as he loves the peoples, all his holy ones, they are in your hand. The verse is explained thus. Amar Moshe lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moses says before the God, blessed is God. Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe. Afilu v'sha'asha tamechabev amim. Even at the time where you cherish all the different peoples. In other words, where you hold others in maybe higher regard or at least let them have their ascension in the annals of history, and we, the Jews, are subjugated. Kol kedoshav yihyu biyadecha, all the holy men of Israel will be in your hands, and they'll be protected by you, since the Holy Torah, as you see here, sages need no special protection. They are exempt from taxes that may be used for security purposes, such as the head tax, is his point. Right? So he feels like Torah is the protection. Where do we hear that?
At the time of the Torah, there was no rabbi. Rabbi is the invention of much later time.
Of course not. So you could always make the argument that by saying that the rabbis are, what's the midrashic move? Kedoshav biyadecha. He uses in the verse, the holy ones are in your hands. And he says, oh, that's the rabbis. This rabbi is saying, oh, that's the rabbis who are being protected by God. Ron's point is, oh, but how can you say that if there were no rabbis and I'm quoting to you as the Torah verse? Time is
flat.
No concern. Of course the rabbis were there at the moment God gave Torah. Because God knew exactly what was happening with history unfolding. The next...
So what does that mean? Protected from taxes? I mean,
they're protected from taxes. They're protected without taxes. In other words, if you're going to levy a tax on me for the defense fund, I don't have to pay that.
They're defending because God is looking after them. Is that it?
Right. Like in Israel today?
Oh, see, that's the parallel. What do they say in Israel today?
They're quoting the same thing.
They're, in essence, when they say that I'm part of the army protecting the people and protecting the land by being in this yeshiva, right? That's basically the equal and opposite of what this is saying.
Right.
What, Jay?
Yeah, well, because it's equal and opposite, it's the same book. This, I take it, this quote-unquote translation, I mean, that's implied. I mean, do you believe that's what the Gemara means? Because it's such Gemara logic to me.
That's the Midrashic move.
That's the Midrashic move. That they're exempted from the tax because the tax is used for collecting.
Yeah, because it's in the context of the story of Rav Nachman bar Rechista, you know, imposing the tax, and Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak says, no, you're wrong, I've got you, you know, you're wrong, Deoraita, Navi, Ketuvim, and I'm going to show you how the drush works against you. And by the way, the conversation that we just came off, if you remember from 2 weeks ago, which I don't expect you to, so I'll just, you know, we had this conversation where we were talking about whether the Chachamim actually had to pay in to the defense fund.
Well, to say that, it's a linear descent from that argument that those who were most likely to be invaded were the ones who should pay the most. And here, if they're exempt because God's going to protect them, then there's no reason for them to pay for protection.
Right, exactly. They are the towers themselves.
It's more difficult to work that out logistically when you're invaded. You still have to protect the rabbi standing next to you when you're the soldier or whatever.
No doubt about it.
The rabbi be alone and not in the front line.
They'll be the front phalanx.
There's also of the Hasidim who study Torah all day. Their wives and children are on the dole. Is supported by charity because they are the scholars of the Torah.
Oh, this is you know, the way that they contribute, right?
Of course, they're the guardians of the community.
Yeah, is that they're the guardians
of... They're earning merit for us.
Not only for themselves, right. The point
for
is
us.
For us as well.
Think they gave it to you once?
Yes, that is exactly the... The point.
My merit is going right.
But they have no problem suggesting that they are entitled to special protection from God just because they're rabbis. I mean, because... I would have thought, man, oh, B'nai Yisrael, because he's saying at the time when you love all the peoples of the earth, but Kol Kedoshav Yehi. So the original meaning to me of that would have been, even though you love all the peoples of the world, Israel is something special.
Right.
So they have no problem suggesting that in the community.
I mean, we're entitled beautiful to read. Something. You're right. Others read it that way. You can read it that way. And you have the willingness recorded here to say that we have to look at it like we are the ones, because we're the ones holding it up for everybody, as Rana just expressed. And so what's interesting here, you will see within the unfolding of the interpretations of the Pesukim that we're about to drush, or read their drushes on it, that there's a little bit of a debate Like, are we really going too far? Even though it doesn't sound like they're asking that, they're not going to say that question specifically. And are we going too far with this? But by recording the debate within the Midrash that we're about to read, they are having, in a certain way, a reflective moment, the same question, they are asking the same question that you just asked, in a self-reflective way, but still expressing their willingness to read it very particularly, like, yes, that means we are the ones protecting the people, yes, that means we shouldn't pay taxes, and it puts us into this different kind of place.
It's also the precedent in the Torah for the Levites being separated and having special privileges because they're denied land, so they're compensated in that way, but clearly singling them out. I don't know if the rabbis perceived themselves as, whether they were Leviim or not, as linear descendants of that, but it seems to have much of the same flavor.
Yeah, I mean, this whole notion of priestly and Levitical kind of status, right? Moshe becomes Moshe Rabbeinu.
Right.
And Moshe and Aharon obviously represent that whole, you know, kind of leadership cadre.
But now it's not inherited anymore.
Right. I mean, for the rabbis, in a certain way, by taking on Moses as their teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu, and then superimposing Rabbanut, the rabbinic culture, mm-hmm. on Kohenic, Levitic kind of status and place
right.
in the ranks. Yes, the answer to your, or the I agree with your observation. Yes, they really did think of themselves as having that unique special status.
But again, no longer because of their heredity. Now it's
correct.
Because of their merit.
And in the rabbinic system, they're going to give some nod to that old way of having Kohenic, Levitical, and Yisrael status, and they're going to keep that, and we're going to keep that alive to this day, the way we call up Aliyot to the Torah. And, you're right, this is going to afford them a status. They are basically affording themselves a status within these annals, within these passages of Gemara, that kind of say, okay, let's figure out how much are we going to differentiate ourselves in the context of our society?
Thing I don't get, the rabbis at this point, unlike the rabbi, my chronology is not that great. Like in Pirkei Avot, the mm-hmm. rabbis then, it was they had a profession. They were a shoemaker.
Some.
Were these just rabbis making a living from being a rabbi?
So these are not those rabbis. At least they're not listed here, right? And you're right that many of them are shown to be rabbis who do have professions. If you recall, the Masorti movement in Israel did an entire campaign about all the different rabbis who had jobs listed, right? Who were industrious in real kind of...
In an attempt to
get
some rabbis.
What's that?
Rambam.
Yeah, many, but even in the Gemara. So there was a campaign done by Masorti. Maybe I will try to remember to bring in, I saved the poster that they came out with all the different rabbinic jobs listed in the Who's. But they're not talking about that here. And you'll see in a moment that they're not
talking about these individual rabbis.
They're not only these individual, they're talking about a class of people who make their living kind of being students of Torah and teaching Torah, going from place to place. And that's the important piece. So let's read the drushes. You mind? Let's read the drushes so that you see how it all plays out here in the text. Okay, so then he says, you've also transgressed what's written in the prophets. Adinivye dichtiv, in the prophets it's written, Gam ki yitnuva goyim ata akabetzem, v'yachelu me'at mimasam melech sarim. Even when they ingratiate themselves with the nations, I will gather them now, and they will be somewhat humbled by the burdens of kings and officers. So Ula says the following, Amar Ula, Pasuk ze belashon aramit nemar. Part of this verse is stated in the Aramaic language, thus the meaning of the verse is as follows. In other words, he goes with what Onkelos translates into Aramaic, which is an interesting move by way of interpreting a verse. Itanu kulhu. If all the Jews study the Torah in exile, so they say that gam ki yitnu vagoyim turns into itanu kulhu. Meaning, if everyone, tanu, as in our saying, in our language of the Gemara, tanu rabbanan, we often hear that in our Gemara study, right? So the Aramaic is used to translate this verse, and the drush then that's presented here is a drush using the Aramaic language. Interesting. E tanu kulhu, if all the Jews study Torah in exile, all, and here's again relating to Jay, what you brought up about the all versus the rabbis, ata akabtem, I will gather and return them to Eretz Yisrael now. Ve'im me'at mehem, but if only a few of them study in exile, who are the few, by the way?
The rabbis.
The rabbis, of course. And by the way, do they exist, Ron, in exile? In this exile, when they're but do they exist in exile? Yes.
2,000 years later.
Yechelu mimasa melech v'sarim. These scholars will be released from the burdens of the kings and officers. And what are the burdens of kings and officers that we're talking about being released from?
Taxes.
Taxes. And you then wait. This is
by kings and officers.
Yeah. And then what's the problem there? Let's identify the problem. If I create the polis and I have Jewish leaders and those Jewish leaders are trusting the laws of the rabbis themselves and they're using the Mishnah to create the taxes and to create the equitable distribution of resources and to bring tzedakah into play because the rabbis are writing their entire code on this kind of commandment, the force of the commandments of tzedakah from the Torah, what's the big problem? Then the rabbis are exempting themselves from it. What gives? But what gives is, the Torah, the prophets, and the writings give space for the rabbis to be the ones to not have to carry that burden. And it's proven from the verses we just drushed. Rav Nachman says about the ketuvim, adichetuve dichtiv, and in the writings, you've transgressed this precept of the writings, minada v'lo v'halach lo shalit l'mir me'aleim. It shall be unlawful to impose upon the Levites taxes and tithes. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. What's that?
What are the writings? What do they mean by the writings?
The third part of the Tanakh is called the writings. So it starts with Psalms. It goes to Proverbs, the five Megillot, and books of Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah. The third part of the Tanakh, our Jewish Bible.
Does it have another name that I'm trying to think of?
Writings. Okay, so Amar Rav Yehuda, and Rav Yehuda said, Minada zu menata melech. Ladies, this is the king's portion. Velo zu kesef gul galta. This is the head tax. Right? Because what is a gul galta? What does that remind you of? Galgolet. A skull. A skull. V'halach zu arnuna. There you go.
Arnuna.
That's your arnuna.
Yeah.
If you go to Israel and you're the rabbi,
you have minister tax is by apartment. It's called arnuna.
Right. So the arnuna in
even if you rent an apartment, the renter has the obligation to pay the arnuna, not the owner.
That's right. That's right. So this word is in the Gemara. If you didn't know,
by the guy who lives in the property, the resident.
So I went to Israel and I learned quickly that I was responsible, even as a rabbinical student, for my arnona.
Really?
Of course.
Yep. Well, what do you mean?
Of course.
You're on your road to no taxes.
I did not know this Gemara and how they were being over, they were transgressing Torah and writings and prophets. I should have gone to City Hall. Unjust. This should have been. Look at in the Vilna if you want to go to a page of Hebrew with me. Arnona in the Rashi, just for a second. Let's see what he says about Arnona. It says take your claims to the Misrad Apanim. No.
Misrad Apanim, not Apanim.
You know, have you ever been to Panovich in Bnei Brak?
No, I've been in Bnei Brak, but I
never... They say, like, אפשר ממש לברך על קייס קאפי הזה. You know, it says you can make a blessing on this cup of coffee. You know, and they use certain inflection in Hebrew that's kind of remembering the good old Yiddish pronunciation. So. Anyway, Arnona. It's on the about 10th line of Rashi, in the narrow section. Remember that. Here, look. If you look on page 8 Aleph, 8 Chet with one dot. So turn in the packet. If you have the packet closed in front of you, the first page you have is Zion with two dots.
Some people don't have it.
Yeah,
oh, you don't have it?
We don't have it.
There's one packet. There was a package of Hebrew over there, Jay, that was making itself around.
Chet with
one dot.
Yeah, we got this.
Give me another second page.
Do you have one, David? Send it in. Can you send another one down?
Another one.
I know. These types, they get you. They get you.
We're on Chet. What did you say?
We're on... So, Chet Aleph.
One dot.
It's the second page in the packet if you open the Hebrew way. Okay. And remember that the middle text is the Vilna, and Rashi, in this case, is just to the right of it. And Arnona is on about the 10th or 11th line down. It's bolded. It's the first. It's where you have, right. It's where you have the little decoration on the right. Arnona. Isorei tevuot uvehemot midei shana v'shana. So you don't have to pay with money, your Arnona. You can bring them
food,
a tithing of your beasts and your produce. You bring them food. So, just so we understand what they're saying. You don't have to do any levies that the king would levy. You don't have to do the head tax, the gulgalta, and you don't have to do the arnuna, which is the tithe of produce and animals. So if a rabbi lives in the polis or is in the polis, doesn't have to pay with the money. And if the rabbi has major fields, then the rabbi would be exempt from those things too. So those are the drushes that they bring when they want to argue against Rav Nachman Bar Chista, who imposed a head tax on the rabbis. Now,
it's just a Golgotha tax only, one out of three, right?
Well, no, all of them. He says, I have these traditions that these three in this verse...
No, but the rabbis only imposed one tax.
Oh, well, he only did a head tax, correct. But he had a tradition that you don't have to pay any of them.
No, but it's property or the responsibility.
Bottom line is, that's the end of this little piece. Mm-hmm. There's no response.
Oh, and there's no, like, final...
And seemingly... There's going to be some sense of finality based on some other sources that we can look at. But in this moment, there's not a Rav Nachman Bar Chista comes back and says after these three drushes. So, I have learned this piece before. It wasn't the first class we took. What was our discussion? Here's what I always ask my students when we looked at this one piece of not participating. You create what Rav Nachman Bar Chista says back to Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak and what he's saying in the name of Ula and these three drushes. You've already expressed that you're a little annoyed. So what could he say? What could he say back to these drushot?
I have 2 points that I want to make, and maybe it's the answer. One is to lead by example. The rabbi is the leader of the community. He should be the first to pay the taxes. That's number one. And I don't understand why they exempt themselves of being the correct leader of the community. And number two, they talked here about the protection of the rabbi. God will protect them. But they know in the Bible, in Krav Even Ezer, that God couldn't protect himself. When they lost the first 3,000 dead people in the fight against the Plishtim, they went to Shiloh, they took formally the covenant, they went with the covenant back to the field and lost 40,000 people. So God couldn't protect them and himself. The covenant went up to the Plishtim, they took control of it for a while.
The Ark of the Covenant.
The Ark of the Covenant. So they know it. So how they can say that God will protect me?
Even that, what they said was, to that point, even when your children are enslaved, even when your children are
suffering,
these few will ultimately protect them and bring about, then, their point is redemption. So in their mind, their contribution is that we're guarding towards the redemption that God will one day shower upon the Jewish people. To your other point, though, leading by example, that's the most fascinating piece here, right? How could, at a certain point, even if it's just we took it from here and we've gone to here, how could they not consider themselves to be
Israel,
responsible for the system that they've created,
right,
within this Mishnah, right? So I only have one.
I would say two things. One is the Levites were tithed.
Okay, so there's one example,
right? And our president-elect does not pay taxes.
So, all right, learning from today, back to then,
it's pretty clear.
But talking about the Levites.
Yeah, but the Levite job was completely holy. They were not allowed to do anything else.
But they were still obligated to be tithed.
Yeah, that's
right.
That's what I'm saying.
Even the holy Levites.
Right.
If they want to wrap themselves in
the Levitical tradition, I'm saying they've got to come up with another reason, because in that tradition, the Levites were tithed.
It's a good
concept. So the Peshat explanation comes through the understanding of the Maharsha. The Maharsha is the one who writes the commentary on Agadot, legends, Midrash, all kinds of things like that. It's mentioned in footnote 9 down on the bottom. I looked at it inside today. He says, listen, all these people were migrant Torah scholars. And we're talking about the class of migrant Torah scholars, in other words, itinerant teachers, itinerant preachers, who never really dwelled in a city for more than 12 months. And therefore, they weren't really considered residents, and all those little particulars about who really is responsible and how long it was. They didn't buy property in the city, and they didn't live there for 12 months. And so when they come in and really establish a place, and they want to do some teaching for a while,
they
shouldn't pay, because they're only there for a while. They're not living there for more than the year.
Then you don't need to discuss it separately, because they fall into that category anyhow. So it doesn't make sense. Because if they're not there for a year, then they fall into the category of the people.
So that's the problem with the Maharsha's explanation.
Right.
That is exactly it. If already we have the explanation that you're not there, did they have to go through and say, I have the drush, but then here's the answer to the problem on the Maharsha, which you brought the problem. The rabbis who felt as though, for most people, that they should just leave it, that you're there for 12 months, you don't have to participate. Maybe if a rabbi comes to town for 2 months, they feel the great pressure to participate in the head tax if they've moved in the month that the head tax is actually required of the people, collected from the people. And therefore, the way that we can answer the Maharsha and deal with this problem that you've brought forward is to say, I'm there for 2 months, I feel like I'm part of the city. They've welcomed me so gloriously. That's how Jewish people make rabbis feel. Welcome and wonderful. And, right? And therefore, they felt the pressure to participate in it. And what Rav Nachman Bar Chista did is he said, rabbis, we should really be participating here. And the colleagues reminded him, listen, we have these 3 drashot, and we don't want to set a precedent, because we can't do it everywhere. We can't do it everywhere. And giving somebody the benefit of the doubt to get our frustrations into the check, giving them the benefit of the doubt in that vein, we have to decide like how we can give them the benefit of the doubt so that we are not seeing them step away from the responsibility that Davka they created in the Mishnah. So we know that they really believe in these systems. And they're not just trying to kind of skirt around all possible responsibility. Now, coupled with what we studied before this was already 2 weeks ago, as we said, that maybe the Torah is their defense and that they don't have to pay for a wall. Maybe you want to take up issue with that and say, if everybody else is paying for a wall, why don't you pay for a wall? And how could your Torah really be part of actually protecting us? We actually need this wall, Allah. Bring up the stories that you brought forward in the books of the prophets themselves. That's a different story. This, I think, is talking about, perhaps, if the Maharshal is onto it, and that's the received tradition, one of those kind of issues that maybe, you know, again, Rav Nachman Bar Chisa felt the responsibility, and Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, wait. We have traditions about this.
Didn't they have a head tax in the time of the Beit HaMikdash? You have to bring a shekel.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yes. Just the reason Israel got broken between the two tribes of the temple.
The half shekels.
Right.
Doesn't say anything about...
Solomon wanted too much money and too many slaves.
Yeah.
I think it's a game they were playing here.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed.
Yeah. But if that's...
Rav Nachman... We had two names. We were both Rav Nachman. So the positive, maybe we shouldn't have to pay any taxes. But he actually is imposing the tax himself. It's just some idea going through.
His study of the Torah is protecting him. Because it's not working. That's the problem.
But there's a principle.
The
assumption is that the rabbi has no money because he spends all his time studying and teaching. But actually, maybe his father was an extremely wealthy man. So you might have a lot of assets even though you have no income.
Could be.
The whole argument is spurious.
Right. And what about resident rabbis who were there for more than 12 months, who lived there?
Yeah, so that could be the question. That's why the Maharshal.
Keep going.
Right.
Itinerant.
There's another mission that says if you leave a place for more than two Shabbos in a row, it's really like you didn't live there.
So we come from a very democratic thought process where people are supposed to feel on the same level. And it's embarrassing to put yourself above other people. But that's pretty modern. So there were groups of people that were considered different, and different in ways that are better. And it's interesting to get into a pre-democratic thought process.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And there is, in the scholarly literature, Bobby, you're hitting on something that's discussed within... Professor Cohen's work on the issue. I was quoting from this article from the Journal of Religious Ethics before. He is talking about communal justice, and he's talking about our responsibility to ask and be honest about just how certain rabbis, and we have to be forgiving of the whole picture and not just say the rabbis, how certain rabbis might have thought of themselves in this class apart. Others did not, and others moved towards really thinking about the depths of pursuit of justice, tzedek tzedek tirdof, that we need to have in all of the walks that we're talking about. And so what I want to call your attention to before we go tonight is the immediate move, and we'll learn it inside the next time. The immediate move, we may have time to, I can't see the call. Oh, we do have time. Good. So let's look at it. There's an immediate move here to thinking about the money and the way we require an orphan to contribute or not to a public works project, because we're really concerned about their their wealth, you know, kind of imagining that they don't come from a lot of assets in the pocket, as Rob was saying, that could be about one of the rabbis or another. No, like, this is not a kid who we're thinking came with any assets, and the money's tight. And so look at now this reaching out to that level of society, and obviously the yatom, the orphan, that trope, we have to think about it in terms of the trope of the prophetic hope that the yatom ve'almana, the orphan and the widow, would be taken care of. So let's look at the Gemara. 8a2, back to the English pages, the left side of the page, 8a2. So right after that conversation, Rav Papa Rama Karya Chadit. Rav Papa imposed a tax for the purpose of digging a new well to get drinking water for people of the town. Ayaitame. And he even levied the tax upon orphans, yatom. An objection was raised. Rav Shisha, the son of Rav Edi, says to Rav Papa, Amar le Rav Shisha b'reid Rav Edi le Rav Papa. V'dilma lo midvil. And perhaps water will never be drawn from the well. The digging will be totally unsuccessful. Rav Papa dismisses the concern. Amar le mishkal shikilna minayhu. Rav Papa told Rav Shisha, I'll collect the tax from the orphans. Imi devil, and if water will ultimately be drawn from the well, midvil it will be drawn. The ilo, and if not, mehadarna la nehalayhu. I shall simply return the money to them. Oh, Rav Yehuda issues two rulings then. Amar Rav Yehuda, Hakol Igle Gapa. We collect from everyone for installing doors to enclose the city's gates. Afilu Miyatme, even from orphans, for they also need protection. Aval Rabbanan Lo Tzriche Mituruta, but the rabbis do not need human protection, and so they are exempt from this tax. Hakol Acharya Patya. Further, we collect from everyone for the digging of the well, afilu merabanan, even for the rabbis, because they require drinking water.
Well, yeah, but the rabbis, why?
No protection, but drinking water.
Oh, they found, though, and
so did they notice that rabbis walked around and they were impervious to things? They needed no protection?
They found... They found a way within the Talmudic parlance here, within the Talmudic argumentation, to get to a place that after that conversation, here was a tax that they absolutely were required to pay. And what could they have done at this moment?
Absolutely.
Look, it says here and there and
that
there
that we protect the
orphans. That this is not, we don't.
They could have done that exactly like they did before, and they could have taken the limud from Kiddushin, from Masechet Kiddushin, that says, Ein Maim Eila Torah. There's nothing, there's no water except Torah, and Torah quenches all thirst.
Yeah,
and they could have gone this whole route, and that's a whole, you know, kind of way that they relate to Torah. But you know what? That didn't happen here. That didn't happen.
They could have also taken Torah portions about protecting the orphan and the widow.
Oh, they could have quoted Navi, and that could have been the ongoing dialogue against the kind of thought process that was unfolding even in the last one, right?
Okay.
That, wait a minute, you could have said about the Yatom that we need to be extra careful and we need to protect and therefore we should contribute. There's no doubt that commentary can come to life at least in the reader's mind, and has in the certain texts that are more social justice oriented. Because whenever you mention the Yatom, as I said before, I said it softly, you're saying a little bit more poignantly, that you're talking about remembering the prophetic literature as soon as you mention that. You really are. And so in this whole picture, you're saying, maybe, by the way, this is for when I really have to consider what I do have. What can I contribute? How much do I really, you know, see myself giving? And if I was a rich man, if I had more, I would simply turn my heart to be generous. Please God, at least the rabbis are suggesting it, from some of the language that's within the Gemara itself. I even want to push it that far. Rav Yehuda qualifies the second ruling, just so we finish this little piece before we go tonight. Lo Amaran Ela, he said, and we have said that the rabbis contribute to the well, right? De Lo Nafke Be'achluza, only when the townspeople do not go out in turns when called to dig the well themselves, but hire workers to do so. Aval Nafke Be'achluza, but if the townspeople go out in turns when called to dig the well themselves, and by the way, if you look at the word achaluza, what does it look close to?
Ochlusia.
It looks close to population. The local population does it. Rabbanan love b'nei mepak ba'achaluza ninhu. The rabbis are not called upon to go out and perform the manual labor. The group takes care of it. But by the way, again, I want to be a generous reader in this case, and that's to say, listen, if we're all going to hire, let's all do this together. Monetarily, if we're going to say as a community, let's do it, you know, then let's build. I would say very generously, that happens oftentimes in shuls. Different people decide to build different things, and they're not necessarily knocking on my door to come and participate in the building projects. But when that happens, you know, lahavdil, to make a distinction between anything, you know, so holy as the Gemara and that time period of the rabbis. But in our time, this happens. Shuls take care of business. They're not necessarily thinking that the rabbis of the shul are going to go and do the exact same work. Jewish communities are building. They're not necessarily saying, they're saying to communities, contribute tzedakah, we're building a Jewish hospice. But they're not necessarily saying, and now rabbis, you all come up with your portion. They're saying to the Jewish community, and the community rises, the ochluza, the ochlusia. Some say ochluza, by the way, means just in shifts, and that there are groups that go out in shifts, but some really link it to this word ochlusia. And I think by, at this moment, having the word ochluza there, ochlusia, the population, it's kind of saying, and by the way, there will be tides within the reality of population, generosity, tides of generosity. There will be times when the population needs to be treated as though, you know, there's only a certain amount of resources and we can only do this much and we have to put our own hands to it. And there are times when the population will have to figure out with their local itinerant rabbis and other rabbis just when they really do need to participate, like with the well, if they're not going to participate in the wall. And all this is a workout for how we best do this polis building that we talked about from the get-go.
Thank you.
If I could ask you for help with making stacks of the text over here, the English and the Hebrew, and then these Mishnayot, Ela Sfarim She'elukhei Neshama, these are the books that go on this shelf here. Run. Number four, set number four on the right side. Thank you. Yes, yeah, Sunday, yeah. We're on.
And I just want to double check on the name. Do you have it?
Need it.
Yeah. Feige, Kana.